Hey, welcome to the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. Glad to have you joining me from everywhere and everywhere around planet Earth. Time to get to it, my friends. Up the down staircase, in the outdoor. Make sense out of the senseless, if at all possible. Once again, find the obvious buried in the absurd. Let's go. Pretty ambitious for very early in the morning here, but the coffee is on, and it's a little cold here in Chicago this morning on a Saturday. You know, it's the weathermen and ladies are having an interesting time trying to figure this stuff out. It's one of those things that has been around as long as there's been people predicting the weather, right? I mean, I have a friend of mine, Tom Skilling, who is arguably, and you could argue about it because we argue about most things, don't we? Arguably the most trusted weatherman, definitely in Chicago, if not the Midwest, and could be in line in the country, right? A nationwide kind of thing. And even he admits, you know, you can go find out what you want to know online now. You don't need him to tell you. But yesterday I was watching a little bit of television. I was getting ready to go out last night, and we were headed to the Chicago Symphony, which was just a great thing. They do these movies at the Chicago Symphony. My friend Richard Kaufman, who will be a guest here on my new show coming up, The Tao of Music, in a few weeks. What an storied, this career of this guy is incredible. But anyway, he was conducting the Chicago Symphony, and the movie was Jurassic Park. And I've seen it probably 50 times. It's a great movie, but to see it up on this massive screen with the Chicago Symphony playing the score is just a whole nother level. But anyway, how am I going to dress going out last night? So I had to check out the weather. And of course, it was a little bit of snow coming in. And it's unseasonably cold for this time of the year. And then they show the whole graph, you know, like what the coldest day was in 1894. The warmest day was in 1974. And today we're 6 degrees below both of those and above one. And anyway, the whole thought of predicting things has been in my mind a lot. And it is not possible to predict a lot of what goes on in the world. And yet, on the other hand, just like being someone who's doing the weather, there are things you can count on for sure. I mean, if you're doing the weather in San Diego, it's probably not a tough gig, right? So, and the CSO aside, which was fantastic, this past week, I have, again, full disclaimer and full disclosure, I never want to turn this microphone on just to talk about what's going on in the world wrong. I mean, that's what most of radio is, quite frankly, and sports talk radio and any other kind of talk radio, for the most part, is here's all the horrible things going on in the world. Call me and tell me what you think. I've never been real good at doing that because you calling me, for example, when I was on WGN here in Chicago, there was a lot of shows that it's like, let's just run down the headlines and then take phone calls on how bad things are. It doesn't change anything. And if nothing else, and sometimes it isn't anything else, is my ongoing attempt, as I say in the open of this show, to make sense out of the senseless and find the obvious buried in the absurd. And when you do that, at least in my opinion, observation and experience, maybe you can do something about those things. So in the movie last night, Jurassic Park, Jeff Goldblum plays this scientist. He's a chaotician. And he talks about the science of chaos being an unpredictable thing, where science works in a linear fashion. He's talking in non-linear fashion. That rings my bell because most of life to me is, it looks linear, and sometimes it is, but you get these curveballs you can never expect, like pandemics, wars, and yet on the other hand, they've happened before, so they're not totally unexpected. But anyway, he's doing this little experiment with Laura Dern, and he's dropping this little thing of water on her hand, and it goes one way, and then she's supposed to predict which way it's going to go the next time, and it goes in a different way. And you know, it's a simplistic little thing, but I think it made a huge point in the movie, and it made a huge point in my mind, enough to kind of share that things can be going a certain way for a certain amount of time, and then make a total left turn, and we're not prepared, even though it may have happened before. So to me, that preparedness is like all important. As the old saying goes, it's better to be prepared and not have an opportunity than have an opportunity and not be prepared. And that's, opportunity is not always a positive thing. These opportunities, I think, in the world are in disguise in some degree, these difficulties. And it's hard sometimes to sift through that stuff because we are bombarded with here's what's not working. When in fact, you, again, digging for some absurdity here and some obvious truths and things, within things, within difficulties, there is something to be gained in there. You know, I have so many people in my life over the years that have been up against serious health issues, my daughter included. And she's had two kidney transplants. I gave her a kidney when she was 13. It lasted till 2018. So I gave it to her in 2002, and it lasted, to be clear, to 2018. So then she spent 2.5 years on dialysis, which is hell. And anybody going through that, you know, you hear the word, you go past these kidney centers, you go, oh, there's a dialysis center. And it is a miracle of science. They're able to clean the blood the way that they do, but it's very, very difficult and hard on the human body. Came through that. And, you know, the odds rolled in her favor one more time, and some pretty incredible events took place for her to get a second kidney. And that was just over a year ago in January. And she's doing great, doing fantastic. And in all of that, she has told me numerous times, Dad, there are things I've learned about myself that I would have never learned any other way without this whole kidney thing. Now, look. As her father, I'd rather she'd skipped all that and just had normal life like most of us do as far as health goes. But that's not in the cards for her. That's not her journey. And her journey was this way. And so for me to hear that from my own daughter and many people, I've had friends of mine who have had cancer, terminal people, who have said, this is the gift I was waiting for. I'm like, wait, what? So while I've had some serious physical interruptions in my life, you know, being electrocuted and if we get this car accident back in 1986 that basically ended my life for the second time. The electrical thing was the first time. The car accident was the second time. Those were different. And I think they were different because I was telling this to myself. Wow, this isn't on my program. This isn't what I planned. And then I had to deal with what was there or not. And some people don't. And really at the crux of the show today, I think, is that or not thing. Yes or no. It's a decision when these things come into our lives, whether they're on the micro, just for us or the people around us, or on the macro, which is what you see on the news. And here's all, you know, the shit's hitting the fan again in the world, and people act in a certain way, and people are dying. And there's so in all of that comes this concept that I've talked about for years since I learned it. And it's from a class that I took when I went back to college after being in the service, kinesiology. Kinesiology is basically the study of human movement. And my teacher, no kidding, was Betty White. That was her name. She was fan-frickin-tastic. I mean, tough as nails and just great humor and really pushed her students. And, you know, I'd already gone through the service and came out, and I thought I was pretty seasoned. But she was a drill sergeant at times, and I really appreciated that. But Betty taught the kinesiology class, and the main tenet, or at least one of the main tenets of kinesiology, is that your body adapts to the demand placed on it. Whether you put the demand on it, or life puts a demand on it, or whatever, your body then has to adapt or not to that demand. And so my kinesiology thesis was on the squat movement, which is putting weights on your shoulders and then going down and bottoming out and coming back up, you know, kind of doing that. And can't do that anymore, at least not with the weight that I used to, but the basics are the same. And so every step of that movement, from the time you put that weight on your shoulders and the down motion to where you're squatting and then for a second and then back up, all of that entails so many millions and billions of little movements inside the human machine. It's nearly incalculable. But when you do that in a repetitive form, you get stronger. You don't get weaker. Just understand this. And this is really something that I've kept in mind all these years. Every time I go into the gym to work out, I don't get weaker. I get stronger. Or at least I'm able to maintain the strength that I have. I'm 63 now. I certainly can't push the weights like I did when I was 23, 33, or 43. 53, we're kind of getting on the edge there. But I still go in and I still go through the same motions and the same movements. But the stressors are a little different because I don't need that big weight anymore. Listen, every now and again, I'll kind of try to show off to myself. I was in there middle of the week and there's something called the incline bench press where you you know, you're, instead of laying flat on your back, you're up in a chair kind of deal, or, and the bench is up higher, and you kind of, it's a different part of the chest. It's easier on the shoulders for me. So I was able to knock out a couple sets with 2.25 on there. I felt pretty good about that. Couldn't hardly raise my arm the next day, but I was able to do that. But the point being is that it's the motions that you do in a repetitive form that make or break the body in so many different ways. And the body eventually shows that stressor or that effort. It's a machine. Understand this. It is a machine at its most basic form. An incredible machine, the most incredible machine, but it's still a machine. And how you use the machine really depends on its viability over a long period of time. So like every vehicle I've ever had, it's all about preventative maintenance. You know, I learned that when I was in auto shop in high school. When I went in the Coast Guard and we had to do maintenance on the helicopters, it was like every 6 hours you did this, and every 12 hours you did this, and every 24 hours you did this, every 48 hours you did this, once a week you did this. It was ongoing maintenance all the time. And there's a reason for that. It lessens the chance of breakdown. When you're repairing things and replacing things and monitoring things, you're far better off in the long run than you would if you just ignore all that, wait for the heart attack, and go, oh, maybe I should start walking, which is what a majority of folks do, unfortunately. But those are the wake-up calls that come, and that's where this specific adaptation to imposed demands comes from, SAID principle. It is the tenet of kinesiology. So, for example, one more time, I have this really cool couch in my studio. If I just went in there in the morning in the studio and laid on the couch and ate whatever, what's not good for you, I don't know, 6 boxes of Oreos, and I did that every day, in short time, my machine would show that. No question. There's been times I kind of went in that direction. Conversely, when I go into the gym and I get on the treadmill and I go through the machines and I get some weights and I work up a sweat and, you know, get the heart rate up, the machine goes in that direction. It's very simple. Doesn't mean it's always easy. And easy is not part of the recipe when it comes to fitness sometimes. Just isn't. And I think the reason a lot of folks don't do it, and listen, I was a personal trainer for 5 years, so I get this. A reason that a lot of people don't do it is uncomfortable. And life's uncomfortable sometimes enough as it is. Why would you want to go be more uncomfortable, especially in the early times when you don't see the immediate results? It's taken X amount of years for your body to get in this certain shape. It does not undo itself in a week. I don't care what you see on television. So with all that being said, SAID, specific adaptation to imposed demands, pounding away on the treadmill, and another thought came in. And I've talked about this a little bit before, and I wanted to expand on it. And to be clear, this is a reminder to me first and foremost. I am constantly reminding myself that every time I do a radio show or work on a book or do a podcast, I'm also the student, because we always teach what we need most to learn ourselves. That's the fact. At least that's how I see it. You know, I have not mastered anything. I'm in constant internship, even at 63, and even doing 10,000 or more hours of radio, and I'm always learning something. Listen, I'm working without an ed here. I don't have any notes, nothing, you know? And the only reason I can even attempt to do that is because I've done it so many times before without notes. I mean, I started radio that was live radio. There's no such thing as podcasting back then. So working without an ed doesn't bother me in the least. I'll tell you what, conversely, if you gave me 20 scripts to read, you know, when I do audiobook work and stuff like that, it's a whole different part of my brain. But for the most part, when I do these shows, it's just like, turn on and let's get going. It's like when I go to the gym, let's get going. What are we going to do today? So SAID, specific adaptation to imposed demands, again, main tenet of kinesiology and movement of the human body. I'm banging away on the treadmill, and I have this thought about a guy I have not thought about. Decades. Why things pop up in our heads, I'm not really sure. For me, when I'm busy doing something else, like working out or being on the treadmill, you kind of get into that mindless state. And I think some file drawers open up and go, oh, remember this? For whatever reason, I started thinking about a guy named Bob G. Sills. And Bob G. Sills was the pastor, Reverend Bob G. Sills, of the Irving Park Presbyterian Church, IPPC. And it was, I don't know, a third of a mile from our house. And Bob G showed up at the church probably in the early 70s, I'd guess. Very influential time for me. He replaced Reverend Elfman, as I recall. Can't barely remember that guy, but Bob G is unforgettable to me. And Bob G. Sills was a stout fellow. He was, I think, as close as I could get to meeting Teddy Roosevelt to some degree, who's one of my longtime heroes. This is a guy who said that he was picking cotton one day, and the Lord tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Bob, it's your turn." And so Bob went to seminary and did all the things he had to do to become part of the Presbyterian faith, and he ended up in Chicago with his wife, Jan. God, you remember these names. And he was there, I guess, 6 years, 7 years, something like that. But it seemed like he was there right for me. Now, I'm sure there were other people there. They loved this guy. As I recall, Reverend Elfman was more of an old world guy, kind of we would say a Bible thumper and a little bit more hellfire and brimstone. And Bob G. came in saying, "It's up to you." So while I don't remember any of the sermons Bob G. gave, I do remember how they made me feel. And they made me feel stronger, not weaker. They made me feel affirmed and not guilty. They made me feel like I was a part of something, not apart from something. Bob G. had this flowing white mustache, shock full of white hair on his head, kind of those wire glasses like Teddy Roosevelt had, and he had a gap in the front of his teeth and a hearty laugh, barrel-chested guy, was often seen in powder blue leisure suits with white boots in the 70s. I mean, how could you not? And he was just this towering presence. I'm sure back then he wasn't a very large man, but to me, he seemed to be larger than life. And I realized over time as I was going there that I was learning something that I never intended to learn, at least consciously. Church was not something that my family was ever participating in. St. Edward's was the Catholic church nearby, and my folks didn't want anything to do with that. There was a Lutheran church right down the street. That didn't ring a bell. But somehow this Presbyterian thing happened, and I think part of that was because I played basketball, and they were recruiting. And I also believe I was in Cub Scouts at the time, and that's where the PAC meeting was held for PAC 3846, thank you. But all of those elements, those pieces, kind of coagulated and put me in, you know, the sights and scope of Bob Sills. And I just have such great memories of him doing his thing, and especially on Christmas Eve. It was just a grand event. And he had the robes on and the whole deal. And I remember sitting up in the upper deck of the Irving Park Presbyterian Church and just being, you know, showered with this guy's energy and wisdom about things. So years later, I never knew what happened to him. And years later, God, this got to be 15 years ago now, I found him, something prompted me to look for him. And I found him at a little church in somewhere northwest of Chicago. And I called the church and talked to the woman. And she's like, "Oh, you know, every now and again, we'll get a call from another place that Bob has, you know, been the pastor of. And he'd love to see you." I said, "Well, don't tell him I'm coming. I don't know if he'll remember me, but don't tell him." Okay. So I go there. I get to the back of the church, sit in the back row. And there he is up front. Much smaller congregation. There could have been more than 25 people there. When he was at his heyday in the 70s, it was a standing room only full house every Sunday morning. And it was much smaller and much darker, as I recall, and he was much older. And he was still up there giving it his all. He was laying the wood to the Spirit, I'm here to tell you. And I just sat in the back, and all of a sudden, I could feel it again. It was like I hadn't been in the gym for a long time, and then I'm back, and I'm listening to this guy. It was a massive trigger for me, and I just kind of sat up a little bit. And he finished his sermon, and they sang a few songs, and he comes walking down the aisle, and I'm sitting in the back row, and I'm not more than 5 feet away from him. And he comes walking down the aisle. He looks at me, and he goes, "About time you got back to church." Oh, my gosh. That was the best. Now, I've always wondered if his secretary, whoever I talked to, tipped him off or not, but he invited me to come back. It was just a great little reunion we had. We sat in his office and he's fired up his pipe. And, you know, I was sitting at the feet of one of the masters in my life. This guy was just incredible. And during that conversation, I'm remembering all this as I'm on the treadmill. And during that conversation, what came up in that talk was building spiritual strength. And I said, "Reverend Sills, please call me Bob G." That kind of voice. "Call me Bob G." I said, Bob G, you know, I remember you at the church in Chicago, and it's full house, and, you know, I mean, all the bells and whistles and high times, all that kind of stuff. And I said, here, it's very different. He goes, oh, yeah. He says, here, nobody knows I'm a rock star. And he went on to talk about how it was humbling for him to do both ends of the spectrum. He was tapped to, and he answered the call. He ended up in Chicago and other few other places, and, you know, had very large congregations, very large followings. And now here he was in a small church with 20 to 25 people, and very, very different. And I kept thinking about how many people he had been in front of all these years. And he said, you know, this was about me building my spiritual strength, that he needed to, you know, because the human ego is about, you know, who's looking at me. It's the what the world is selfies, I guess, is all about. I don't take selfies. I can't fully talk to that. But if it's always about look about me, look about me, you know, check me out, look what I'm doing, then where does the we come in if it's always about me? And so having that conversation with him, he went back to the people and how it related to him, allowing Bob G to fulfill his spiritual destiny by answering the call and going wherever he was needed, whether it was a full house on Sunday or 25 people on a Saturday night. It had to all be the same. And boy, I will tell you, that rang such a bell in me that when I thought about it last week on the treadmill, I had to stop and get off and just sit for a minute and just stew on it, just marinate on that a little bit. I so now identify with that concept. You know, I go back to how my life was before all of this, before radio, before books, before TED Talks, all that stuff, all the things I'm known by to some greater or lesser degree in the world. And before all that, I was just a kid, right? Like everybody was just a kid. But as I grew up and I started to see that there was a route for my life that I thought I was supposed to take, you know, it diverged in the woods and I took the road less traveled. And that came from a literal walk that I took in 1996 from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan to Chicago and back. And it was outside of Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, where I had the tap on my shoulder. And I heard that voice, clear as a bell. Didn't tell me to go to the pulpit per se. It said, go on the radio, John, go on the, I heard it. And I'd never heard anything in my life like that. I don't think I've heard very many since, but it was that clarion moment where it opened up and said, this is what you're supposed to do. Whether there's 3 million people listening or three, it's all the same. So on this morning, as I got ready to get the podcast going and thinking, once again, you know, I have some notes laying around, ideas. This is kind of finding its own route. And so for anyone listening that doubts their path, don't. It doesn't matter really, as Bob pointed out, who's in front of you. It really matters who's inside of you. And what's driving you to do the things that you do in a good way, to serve in the way that only you can. I'm thinking of friends of mine that, you know, they make a huge impression and mark on the world. Richard Kaufman, as I mentioned at the beginning of this broadcast, world-renowned conductor. And last night watching him put the CSO through their paces with a full house, just standing ovation, that's his calling. That's what he's supposed to have. Another friend of mine in the musical industry in a very different way. He's a guy that I played high school football with, and we were co-captains, and he's a longtime friend and a brother to me. And he goes in and he puts the Schurz High School band through their paces. And it's not to a sold out crowd nor standing ovation, I'm here to tell you, but that's what he's supposed to do. And I look around with my friends who are making these incredible impacts in the world, and they're doing what they're supposed to do. Whether they know it or not, I guess maybe isn't that important. But the thing that came back around for me, that acronym of SAID, Specific Adaptation to Impose Demands, took on a little different meaning. So now SAID has changed from Specific Adaptation to Impose Demands to Spiritual Adaptation to Impose Demands. It goes back to the whole trio that the YMCA is built on, mind, body, and spirit, right? So the mind is that generator inside each of us that can collect and spit out information and all the things that comes through with our imagination. And then you got the machine, which is the body, which we've talked about extensively. And then you got that spiritual part that is unseen and unidentified for many people until you get the tap on the shoulder, until you get the knock on the door, until the bell rings, until you hear what you need to hear. And it doesn't matter what point in your life you hear that. And once you hear that, or once you answer the call, other things start happening. It's like dominoes falling. And you get to say yes or no to whatever one you want. That's what free will is all about, at least is for me. So now it's spiritual adaptation to impose demands. So when I see what's going on in the world, in the macro, in the big picture, supposedly, my job is to say, how do I respond to it in a way that makes me stronger, not weaker? How do I become more faithful and less fearful, no matter what's going on? So how do they respond to it, with fear or with faith, right? With strength or with sorrow, I think determines to a great degree how we move through our lives. And that's really what it comes down to. So it's like going into the gym every day, and these things push on us from the big picture to the small things in our lives, whether you're dealing with your kids and something that might be difficult there, or the big picture and you turn on the news and here's what's going on in the Ukraine. All of those things are pressures. And if you position yourself in a way that makes you weaker, it's going to run you over. And part of it is, I think, is that spiritual adaptation to imposed demands is to help you build that spiritual muscle. So when these things come along, they don't crush you. And that's not to say they're not difficult. That's not to say they're not sad or horrible or all those things. That's all part of it. But they don't crush you. They help you remember who you are. Just like I was sitting in the back of that little church when Bob G, all those years later, was still bringing it. And I sat up a little stronger. I remembered some things I had forgotten. And then that last week, I remember this guy, he passed away, I don't know, not long after I talked to him, I think. He was well into his 80s. And I think of him often now, this whole past week. Once I thought of him on Tuesday or Wednesday when I was at the gym, like every day he pops into my head. I'm thinking, these are the things that are in there for me to help me remain strong. So my suggestion to you as I kind of get ready to wrap this up, and I never want to pontificate or bloviate. I'll speculate and sometimes verbally defecate, but I don't want to pontificate too much that I know what's right for you, but I'm just telling you what works for me. And while it is difficult what's going on in the world, finding ways to use that to make us stronger is the only way it makes that weaker. That it brings out the best in us as opposed to the worst in us. The worst is already happening. We see it. How does that not bring out the worst in us, but bring out the best in us? How do we turn that? In so many ways, I think that is the great challenge of humanity, is how do we turn that lower level energy into something greater than us? We got to find something that's bigger than us in order to overcome that. And I'm not suggesting we all sit around in a circle, hold hands and sing Kumbaya, and that God's going to show up and clean everything up. That's not the deal, at least as I understand it. We're here for each other. We're here to get things done. That's why we're here, in my opinion, my observation, my experience. The odds of being born are 1 in 400 trillion. The two biggest things you have to think about, at least I do, is not so much how I was born, the circumstances of my life being born into, but why I'm here. The how is already done. Why remains to be seen. Until next time, thanks for listening. I appreciate the support of my subscribers and sponsors. Be well, safe travels. Adios.